Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue, where we are joined today by Annie Carnes, the Senior Marketing Communications and Development Manager of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I was raised in the city of St. Louis, so I can remember all these urban development projects that would come along and things would be condemned by eminent domain and people would be moved out of their houses. And one of the results was homelessness.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of, at least since COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement around terms like urban redevelopment, eminent domain, and just in general, how it affects homelessness. Of course, we know that it causes displacement of our low-income, you know, residents in Pittsburgh. It causes gentrification issues due to the rent increasing. And the biggest one that we've seen is just, in general, the loss of affordable housing. You know, new developments tending to be, of course, higher costing, pricing out people that have been living in their neighborhoods for decades. So it's just overall increasing housing insecurity. And something that we talk about often at Light of Life are those just reasons why someone becomes homeless to begin with. You know, we serve over 3,000 unique individuals every year just through our emergency shelter, those that are experiencing homelessness. And all of them have unique stories. You know, some of them, their stories, you know, are an outcome of things like urban redevelopment. You know, they lost their homes because either the economy or these corporations or investors from other cities have found that Pittsburgh is also a good place to call home. You know, more of what Pittsburgh used to be considered an affordable city to live in is becoming less and less. One of the statistics that we use here at the Mission, we know that the city of Pittsburgh is lacking around 40,000 affordable homes for low-income individuals. The statistic is from the National Authority of Housing Coalition. There is an extreme lack of affordable housing for those that are considered low-income renters. And, you know, it's kind of a new thing for Pittsburgh. You know, people tend to focus on cities like Sacramento or Denver, Washington, D.C., some of these larger cities that have always been known for affordable housing crisis.
But it's not just the housing. There are all sorts of issues that can lead someone to become unhoused or homeless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, big ones that we mention, of course, mental health, which, it plays into those that have issues with addiction, and then addiction that plays into issues with people that have mental health. You know, they kind of play off one another. And those are two big ones. And the other one that sort of, you know, stemmed from the pandemic era were people that, you know, lost their jobs during COVID, the economic factors and inflation that have happened over the last 4 years or so. Those are also two big ones, besides, you know, mental health and addiction issues. And then the other one is the affordable housing. So we talk often about those as specific reasons why people become homeless. But, you know, when you sit down and talk to some of the guests that come in and out of the shelter, they all have different stories. And sometimes they don't always align with those top three or four ones that I've just mentioned. Some of their stories would shock you, which is why we always say anybody can become homeless at any point in their lives. It just takes one significant event to happen in an individual's life. You know, your husband, who maybe he's the breadwinner of the family, he has now gotten diagnosed with cancer. Your house catches on fire and now you're displaced. We also know the city of Pittsburgh sees 1,200 individuals were evicted from their homes in the month of January, which we know to have been one of the coldest months and the coldest winters that Pittsburgh has seen in over a decade. So imagine families, you know, not people who have just been displaced because of issues with mental health or addiction. They lost their homes. They were evicted. So that is averaging 40 families a night in the city of Pittsburgh who were evicted, some out on the streets in the bitter cold, others maybe couch surfing among family members. And these are real numbers. You know, this is real life.
I've only lived in Pittsburgh for about 6 years. As I drive down Route 65 or get off 28 to go on the 31st Street Bridge, you always see these people standing there panhandling.
Yeah.
And I feel there, but for the grace of God, I could be there.
Yeah, listen, I'm glad you brought up the panhandling because there's misconceptions, right? You know, people who work within the city limits of Pittsburgh, you know, not just out in the suburbs, maybe they live in the suburbs and they're crossing the 16th Street Bridge. They're getting up on 279. They're about to go through the Fort Pitt tunnels. You know, there's panhandlers at each of these areas consistently, you know, during your daily commute. And I want to share two things. The first thing is big question. What do you do if you come across someone panhandling? Do you give them money? Do you roll down your window? People have different opinions that can swing one way or the other. And something that we try to educate people on is if you are approached by a panhandler, do not give them money. That could be the last $5 they ever spend. We hear stories about people who were given, you know, $5, $10, a dollar. And if they do have alcohol or drug issues, unfortunately, most of the time, that's what they're going to spend their money on. And the last thing that we want is another overdose. So what we suggest is keep some bottles of water in your car in the summer. Keep some hand warmers in your car in the winter. We have something called Hope and Help cards that we have here at the Mission. People are more than welcome to stop by at our Ridge Recovery Place building and pick them up, you know, especially if you're kind of like a daily commuter. And what they are, they list our services, our meal times, more information about our shelter. We're trying to encourage more and more people that light of life. We're here to help. We exist. And those that are, you know, just out on their daily commute and they come across somebody and they feel pressured to give money, give them a granola bar instead. Hand them a Hope and Help card. The second thing that I wanted to mention was for those that are passing the homeless, you know, that are visible out on the street or passing a panhandler. And, you know, for those that aren't familiar with just the homeless population in general, there may be some judgment or some bias. You know, oh, why doesn't that person just get a job? Or, you know, why does that person just go to the shelter and get help? And one of the stories that puts things into perspective a little bit, that not that we like to share it, but because it's so unfortunate and sad, it's just one of those things that makes you think differently. You may know, but Light of Life has a street outreach team, and our team goes out to different encampments around the city every single day. You know, we hit up different encampments throughout the week, and we try to bring them those that are living in the tents or sleeping on porch stoops. Resources, you know, we'll bring them hygiene kits, water. We will drive them back to the shelter so they can get a hot meal, a shower, learn more about what Light of Life offers to help them get off the street. And our street outreach team, there was a gentleman who was just sleeping a few doors down on the stoop of an abandoned building right next to our North Avenue shelter. And our outreach team would go to him almost every day, you know, hey, you know, can you come back? I think his name was Roger. Roger, you want to come back to get a meal? You want shelter? You know, we were offering as much as we possibly could to get him from, you know, keeping from sleeping on the stoop. And, you know, these people that are homeless, not only have they experienced some kind of trauma to get them there, but homelessness in general is so difficult. So they're experiencing even more trauma by sleeping out on the street, not knowing where their next meal is coming from, and then also being vulnerable to the drugs that are out there, and then, of course, harsh weather conditions. It's not like people are desiring always to be out there. So our outreach team would visit Roger to build up this relationship and rapport and just trust with him. It took about a year. before this man decided to get up off the stoop and come into our North Avenue shelter for a meal. And that happens often. It takes a long time to build up trust because some of our homeless have just been burned in the past by trusting other people, organizations, or whatever their story is. And after our outreach team had built up that trust with him, you know, they had asked, do you mind telling us, how did you get here? You know, how did you get into your homeless situation? And, you know, we learned then that the real reason that Roger was not coming into our North Avenue shelter wasn't because he was refusing services. He had developed a mental health condition because of a life situation that he went through 3 years prior, where his house burned down and he was the only member of his family that survived.
Oh my God.
So his wife, his children, they perished in the fire, and his mental state basically had convinced him that he was unworthy of walking into another building because his family never had the option to walk out of one. And in his mind, he believed that he was no longer worthy of having a home, of accepting love, or walking into a building because he had developed a fear of walking out. You know, and so when you passed Roger on the street on your way home in your car, and you know, just a normal person, normal Pittsburgher, normal daily commuter, seeing him a few blocks away from a shelter, mind you, thinking that person just doesn't want to get a job. That person doesn't want any help. You know, this is the homeless cause this for themselves. They could get help. These are stories that we hear every day. And everyone's story, you know, is different, of course, but it really puts things into perspective when you meet people like Roger and you realize, and I turn it around to the people listening, what would you do? I mean, I don't know what I would do if I lost my kids and husband in a fire. I would go crazy. So you have to ask yourself, does that person have more to their story? And, you know, 99.9% of the time, that answer is yes.
We are talking with Annie Carnes of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. And I know that the Light of Life Rescue Mission and Northside Common Ministries and food banks, there are lots of agencies in Pittsburgh that are available to help those who are unhoused or homeless. Where are you actually located? What, you've got the mission on North Avenue, but that's got a special purpose, but I think you've got others as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, a little bit of background for those that may have never even heard of Light of Life Rescue Mission. We have been on the north side of Pittsburgh for over 70 years, serving the homeless and hurting on Pittsburgh's north side. And we started actually as a soup kitchen on the north side. Then they opened it up to emergency shelter for just men. After they had been basically saying, like, okay, let's get some long-term programming in here. So we went from soup kitchen to long-term programming for men, holding things like AA and NA, and then we opened up emergency shelter for men. But, you know, fast forward to today, we are actually no longer at the North Avenue shelter. As of last year, or the tail end of 2023, we opened up a brand new facility called Ridge Recovery Place. And it's on the north side. It was actually the old Allegheny High School vocational tech building next to the CCAC campus on the north side. Huge building. That is where we house all of our long-term programming for men, women, and children. And that's where our donation center is, where our administrative offices are. And that building is in addition to the emergency shelter that we opened up in 2021 called Vetley Street Shelter, which is more on the north shore along River Avenue there. And that is where we have all of our emergency services, you know, hot meals for the homeless. People can come in and get resources, help with obtaining their IDs, which we know is a big barrier for people getting jobs and housing. So that houses all of our emergency services. Just recently, over the last few weeks, we announced that we have now officially partnered with another nonprofit called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. We have always been known for emergency services, you know, hot meals, hot showers, shelter, that sort of thing. And then we started getting into long-term programming years and years back, opened up long-term programming for women and children. But there's been this gap, or lack of focus, I guess is the best word, for people that are on the brink of homelessness. You know, these are the people that are just one paycheck away from losing their home. And they probably are considered in that eviction number that I mentioned earlier, that 1,200 people a month. And so Light of Life had started developing more services such as our donation center, our food pantry. We have something called a free store. And these services are to help people either on the brink of homelessness so that they can focus on just paying their rent. You know, they don't have to worry about buying clothes for their kids because they can, you know, get it at the free store or the donation center. They don't have to worry about groceries because they can buy free food at the food pantry. They don't have to worry about buying groceries. And so one of the other gaps was furniture. Let's say you were homeless at one point and you went through our programs, or maybe you went through another program and now you're getting housing for the first time. You got to worry about furnishing your place, right? You don't want your kids sleeping on the floor. So that's where now we have a new ministry, or an additional ministry, I suppose, called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. So now we help people with furniture needs, which is really exciting.
In what you were saying, there are several really important pieces here. It's not just you're homeless, here's a bed to sleep in and a meal. It's also, how can we help you find a home?
Right, right. And, you know, there's other agencies other than Light of Life. You know, we work with a lot of partners. You know, our donation center alone has 50 partnering organizations. So the people that they're serving can come in, you know, to our donation center and get clothing. And people in our food pantry, same thing. We've got 35, 40 partnering organizations for our food pantry. So now these organizations are coming in and getting food in bulk for the people that and the families that they serve. We all know that, you know, Department of Human Services for the county, they are the main sort of like entry point to get on the list for housing. They use something called Allegheny Link. Mm-hmm. And in our opinion, one of the gaps with the Allegheny Link system is you have to become homeless first before you get on that list. So, and, you know, if you are somebody who's on the brink of homelessness and you know, hey, you're getting evicted next month, it's harder to get housing. And the list is so long that those people that are waiting are the ones that are, you know, staying at Light of Life, Bethlehem Haven, or other, you know, partnering shelters that can give them temporary housing. And, you know, it just takes longer to get that housing that they need.
Now, I go to church on the north side and I ride the 16 bus into downtown. So I go down, you know, Brighton House Road, and there's Northside Common Ministries, and I walk past, you know, where your North Avenue mission used to be. I think it's really important for people to know that you're not the only place in town that's helping people.
Yeah, yeah. And we all talk to each other, you know, and we're getting better at talking to one another. You know, all these partnering agencies, especially during the harsh winter months, there's like a big email that goes out and basically says, here's all the open beds that, you know, we have open for the day. Here's all the open beds that the other person has open for the day. And
oh, very good. Yeah.
And I think that that's super helpful, because what happens is, this is a big question we get. You know, it's 5 degrees outside and somebody walks into Light of Life shelter, let's say at midnight, they're looking for a place to stay. We, of course, have opened something called overflow shelter, because our normal emergency shelter is always full in the winter. And the last thing we want is to send somebody back out on the street, which we don't do. we really exhaust every effort to make sure that they get a bed to stay in somewhere. So, you know, if our shelter's full, we'll go ahead and call East End Cooperative Ministry, you know, say, hey, what's your bed situation look like right now? Now, luckily, the county's opened up the McNocker shelter for their winter plan, so that it's, you know, the ultimate low barrier shelter situation, just to make sure people are getting off the street during the winter. This year's communication amongst providers has improved drastically since last year. I will say that much. So I think it's just continuing that communication with each other. And then there's all these ideas that float around. Well, how can we make it better? How can we make sure that the homeless know where to go? And that's where street outreach teams come in. You know, we've got Light of Life street outreach team. And then, of course, Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net, they have their street outreach team. There are multiple organizations that have teams that go out to the encampments and say, hey, you know, here's a list of places that you can go tonight. Do you need a ride there? So there are systems in place. I think that overall, anything and everything could always improve. And it's a matter of having those resources to have more people be going out and talking to the homeless within their encampments and their tents and, you know, getting them either into a shelter, which sometimes they're hesitant on doing because they got to leave all their, you know, a lot of their stuff in their tents. They come back the next day, it's stolen, you know, everything's gone. So there are people that will choose to stay out in their tents instead of coming into a shelter for one reason or another. You got addiction issues, you got mental health. You have people who are staying in tents who believe that they don't need help at all because their mental health condition is so severe that it's really heartbreaking because you can't convince them that they need help. And, you know, we say it all the time at Light of Life, we need more supportive programming for people with severe mental health. You know, even you know, they'll walk into Light of Life, we will call Western Psych, and then they'll go to Western Psych, they'll get admitted, and then they get discharged in less than a day, and then they're back out on the street. There is a huge mental health capacity. There's a gap there that we really need to start focusing on.
We're talking with Annie Carnes from the Light of Life Rescue Mission, one of the many agencies and shelters that is available to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh. A client comes in and needs a place to stay, needs food, and needs training, needs help with getting their act together enough to be able to deal with an apartment again. Mm-hmm. What are all the kinds of things that you do at Light of Life? Because I imagine that's very similar to what some of the other agencies do as well.
There's certainly a process. You know, you walk in, you seek help. And like I mentioned earlier, everyone's story is different, right? Like everybody has a different story and a unique situation that got them in that spot to begin with, which means, guess what? They're going to need a unique solution to right. help them and get them out of that. So we do an intake. We get to know their story. We have to understand where they came from. How long have they been homeless? Because we know if you've been homeless for, you know, 3 days versus 3 years, that's, you know, you get more trauma the longer right. that you're out there being homeless. So we do an intake. We understand and assess their needs. We have partnered with AHN and Northside Health, the mental health from the Northside. And they actually have staff on site every day, Light of Life. And if they have mental health issues or they need something other health related, we connect them with the counselors on site. We also have people who have jobs and they're homeless. They just can't make enough money to make ends meet to put, for instance, like a down payment on rent, or they may have like lost all their money through a divorce. Like you just don't know their situation, right? They're working, they're going to work and they're coming and they are sleeping at our shelter and going back to work. And a lot of the times there's that embarrassment that comes along with it where the people they work with have no idea that they're homeless and they're staying at our shelter. So we have a special designated program at Light of Life at the emergency shelter, as well as the long-term programs building. At the emergency shelter, we call it Shelter Plus. We have 12 beds for men who, for instance, have jobs and they're just staying at Light of Life. And then High Commitment Shelter, you know, you could stay with us, I think, up to a year for the High Commitment Shelter. We have finance classes for them as well so that they can learn to, you know, save their money appropriately so they can get out of their situation and get them back up on their feet. We also have a mental health program as well as a life recovery program. So if you're dealing with your mental health issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. If you have addiction issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. And then for women and children, same thing. We have a women and children's long-term program. You know, these programs can last up to 2 years or longer, where you live with us at Light of Life for that long. For women and children, the program looks different because they have different needs because children are involved. And oftentimes women who have been through either the homeless system, the shelter system, have gone through addiction, they have either sort of severed the relationship with their children, or, you know, it just doesn't look like a healthy situation. So as a part of their program, we help them get back on this sort of like family mentality and help them build back the relationship with their kids. And so the kids go through our program too, because that means that they're getting the support that they need as well. You know, we partner with the Homeless Children's Education Fund. They help with sort of making sure kids aren't falling behind on the school side if we have a woman in the program. So we have so many options. You know, our street outreach team, we have a day center. The outreach team members, not only do they go to the tents, but if somebody comes into the day center and they're like, hey, you know, I can't get a job. Okay, well, do you have an ID so you can apply for a job? Well, no. Okay, let's go to the DMV. We drive them to the DMV, the Social Security office. We get them their birth certificate. Any barrier that keeps this human being from getting back up on their feet, getting a job, getting housing. We have people that come in who just like, they want a job, they don't want to become homeless, and they're back up on their feet relatively quickly. And then we have people come in, they stay at our emergency shelter, and then finally they make the decision, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to change my life. And then they go into our long-term programs, and then they graduate, and then they get into transitional housing and then permanent housing, and they become alumni. Some of them are now on staff at Light of Life, which is like the best ever, because
role models.
Yes, exactly.
Annie Carnes is so glad that there are agencies like Light of Life Rescue Mission in Pittsburgh to help people. Now, I feel like Light of Life, Northside Common Ministries, all the other private rescue missions are filling in a gap that's not provided for by state, federal, or county government.
Yes. Yeah. Light of Life is funded primarily by private donors, you know, and we have such dedicated donors. And for us, you know, since we haven't been relying so heavily on government funding to do what we do, you know, we are one of the fortunate organizations that doesn't have to necessarily worry about us having to close our doors, because we have such faithful donors, volunteers, you name it. And we couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. But it's a hard subject to talk about, because unlike other cities, you know, nationwide, we truly believe that there is hope for Pittsburgh. We think we are a small enough city, even though the homeless situation has increased dramatically for the city of Pittsburgh over the last 5 years, and it's become more visible. We still believe that this is fixable. You know, like we are small enough, and we have so many great organizations and nonprofits. And for the most part, you know, a county and a city willing to start having these conversations with us as providers to come up with solutions, that we know that change is possible for our city. Our county here in Pittsburgh and our city, I feel like they're leaving all ideas on the table, and they really are trying to find solutions that work, you know. And they could jump the gun and start building tiny homes, which we think isn't that great of an idea, not without wraparound services, but they're not doing that. They're listening to the providers, and we want to keep that conversation going. So I really think recently it's been more of a positive spin, let's just say that much, on how Pittsburgh can get out of this.
What can regular citizens do to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh?
You can educate yourself, truly, you know, on learning how someone becomes homeless to begin with, not passing that judgmental bias that you may have towards homeless people. I think that's a great start. You don't always understand people's stories or how they got there. And of course, I would be remiss without saying, Donate to an organization like Light of Life, or like another nonprofit that is directly serving the homeless and trying to get them help out of their situation. The other thing you could do is, you know, if you are someone who has more time than money, volunteer. Light of Life, we can't do anything without our volunteers. They are truly the heart of the mission, and we have so many volunteers. I think we clocked in 16,000 volunteer hours last year. Yeah, so literally, we can't do what we do without our volunteers. Those are the biggest things, right? Just finding out where you can give back and how.
Annie Carnes, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on Forbes Avenue.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Anytime that we can get to talk about the Pittsburgh homeless situation and educate people, we're all for it.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue to monitor the dismantling of fundamental constitutional protections and laws by the Trump administration.
We're joined by Dalia Taha, policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work.
We then speak with author and anthropologist David Vine about his recent book, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World.
Our guest contends that more than 800 U.S. military installations scattered across foreign lands are not merely symbols of strength, they're often sources of harm, fostering anti-American resentment and propping up authoritarian regimes.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
America is in the midst of a constitutional crisis. Over 200 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration during his first 100 days in office, resulting in over 100 injunctions and stays as Trump lays waste to fundamental constitutional protections and laws passed by Congress. On his first day in office on the second term, Donald Trump had the audacity to sign an executive order claiming he was, quote, restoring freedom of speech. Instead, his administration is systematically destroying the right to speak freely, to write freely, to dissent freely, and to protest freely. Trump ordered the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in both the public and private spheres, and targeted several leading universities, threatening to withhold federal funding for indoctrinating students with woke ideology, and for failing to combat anti-Semitism, by which he means criticism of Israel. He shut down the Voice of America and the Smithsonian Museum. He canceled the security clearances, government contracts, and access to federal buildings of several prominent law firms because he didn't like the clients they represent. He even excluded the Associated Press from the White House because it refused to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. In one of the most egregious violations of the First Amendment, the Trump administration canceled foreign student visas and deported legal permanent residents claiming their constitutionally protected campus protests were contrary to U.S. foreign policy interests. Fortunately, brilliant lawyers, courageous judges, and public interest organizations are fighting back. To discuss these critical issues, we're joined today by Dalia Taha, a policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work. Dalia is a Palestinian-American Muslim. Prior to joining MPAC, she served as project manager at the Texas A&M Foundation, where she researched and analyzed maternal health policy. At MPAC, Dalia works to champion policies and initiatives that uplift and advocate for the Muslim community nationwide, with a particular focus on protecting the First Amendment, academic institutions, and the next generation of American Muslims. I am particularly pleased to have Dalia with us today because she and I are about to launch a podcast called Rapid Response, sponsored by MPAC, in which we will examine the struggle of students and community members, Muslims, Jews, and allies who have been targeted by the Trump administration for expressing political views in favor of Palestinian rights and sovereignty, which the government is seeking to suppress. Dahlia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Steve, for that amazing introduction and for having me on Law and Disorder. I'm very excited to be here today.
We're excited, too. Let's begin with what's happening on campuses. Over the last year, pro-Palestinian students across the country have been arrested, doxxed, suspended, and even threatened with deportation. How is MPAC defending the First Amendment rights of students and faculty members who are being silenced or punished simply for speaking out against Israel's assault on Gaza?
At the Muslim Public Affairs Council, we've made it a top priority to defend the civil liberties of pro-Palestinian students, faculty members, staff who are facing unprecedented repression for their activism. From day one, we've been on the ground in every capacity, whether it's at the universities themselves, in the courts, with organizing with other organizations to be able to best address this repression. We're tackling this from quite literally every angle, from a legal, institutional, political angle. And we've launched a nationwide campaign to expose how universities and public institutions are violating these First Amendment rights. We're publishing detailed reports, statements, and we're supporting, most importantly, these impacted students and faculty member. And we're pushing for these formal investigations into these abuses. We've also been fighting to ensure that academic spaces remain safe spaces for dissent, because criticizing a foreign government is not a form of hate speech, and expressing solidarity with Palestine is not a crime, and that's something that we heavily emphasize. We've taken a very bipartisan, nonpartisan stance on this, working with stakeholders across the board, whether it's Republicans and or Democrats, saying the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and we have to uphold the First Amendment. We have to uphold our civil liberties and our democracy, because it doesn't just start with the Muslim or pro-Palestinian community. We are essentially guinea pigs, right? They start with us, and then it trickles into other communities. So we've been heavily emphasizing that in this nationwide campaign, which is a lot of emphasis on public affairs, exposing what's happening and working with external stakeholders to be able to address it.
Ask a follow-up to that, because we've seen footage of police brutally dismantling student encampments while ignoring violence from pro-Israel counter-protesters. In places like UCLA, the victims were criminalized while the attackers walked free. How is MPAC responding to these double standards in both law enforcement and media coverage?
I'd like to note that what happened at UCLA is a national disgrace, and every single individual, every single American should be outraged by this. Peaceful students were brutally attacked, as you mentioned, by this violent mob, and instead of protecting them, law enforcement, they stood by and then criminalized the victims. There was no sense of accountability. There was no justice. So MPAC responded immediately. We were there on the ground the day after these students were attacked. Our Los Angeles office was there. They went to the courthouses, they went to the jails, and they stood there until these students were released. We've worked with civil rights attorneys. We've worked with constitutional lawyers, other civil rights organizations, and even engaged with members of Congress to be able to essentially outline and expose what happened. We demanded that the city attorney file charges. This happened actually 2 weeks ago. We demanded that the city attorney file charges against the attackers that were there. And just days before the statute of limitations expired, because of our public affairs campaign with other of our coalition partners and our other civic advocacy organizations, they finally did. And that only happened because of sustained public pressure and organizing, which is something that we have a mastery over now. We know that if we allow these injustices to go unaccounted for, then what happens from there? So we're calling out that double standard. We all see that footage. The violence didn't come from the students in the encampment. It came from outside agitators who were allowed to act with impunity. And the media, we've seen it with the media as well. There is such a bias. Far too often, they've echoed it. casting students as extremists while simultaneously erasing the violence they endured. MPAC has continuously pushed back on that narrative and centered student, faculty, and advocates' voices, insisting on full truth, insisting on full accountability, because silence has never been an option and we will not allow it to be an option, and neither is selective justice.
Well, Dahlia, MPAC has long worked at the intersection of national security, civil rights, and public policy. So how are you preparing the American Muslim community and young student organizers in particular for the political and legal challenges that lie ahead?
Thank you so much for that question. So as you mentioned, it's difficult. We all know it's difficult. And especially as the machinery of surveillance, prosecution, and political backlash ramps up against anyone who dares to speak out. Students are terrified. Advocates are terrified. The other day, we saw a judge get arrested. And that's why MPAC is investing deeply in political education, community empowerment, legal empowerment, and above all else, leadership development. We believe in being on the ground. We believe in being in the halls of Congress. We are everywhere that you could potentially find us. We have engaged with a multitude of different stakeholders in the halls of Congress to be able to emphasize the need for justice and accountability. And then through our leadership development, we have a multitude of different fellowship programs where we engage with the next generation of Americans and American Muslims to be able to learn how power works and how to shape it. We just recently launched our webinar series where we work with different civic organizations across the board from different backgrounds and ethnicities to be able to identify where we can come together and fight back against government overreach, oppressive policies, because we've identified that without leadership development, without community engagement, without that political education of what are your rights, a lot of people are left confused and they're left terrified and they're left in essentially, they become the most vulnerable. So we believe in education on every single avenue, in every single way. We believe in educating the masses, educating the community, educating our students. And we do that through our fellowships, our webinars, our political engagement. It's just very, very important that everyone is highly informed of what their rights are and resources that they have available to them.
Well, thank you for that. And as a follow-up, for listeners who want to stand with students, fight back against government overreach, or otherwise support your work, what do you recommend they do right now?
Most importantly, it's essential that you use your voice and you speak out. Using your voice to platform and uplift the truth and reject the criminalization of dissent. Second, show up. Whether that's joining the local protests, attending city council meetings, or writing to your congressional members or university officials. Third, support organizations doing the work. Groups like MPAC that are on the front lines, the ACLU who work legally, politically, and culturally. And lastly, in the next generation. Look into organizations and sponsor a student organizer, mentor them, defend them, because we see that the new administration is targeting our students and they're instilling into them a sense of fear because they know if there's that fear, a lot of these kids are going to get kicked out of their schools. They might get deported. So they're less inclined and less likely to go protest. They're less likely to voice dissent, less likely to use their First Amendment right to speech, right? So it's essential that we empower them because what we're witnessing isn't just a crack down on protests. It's an attempt to suppress an entire generation and an entire movement that advocates for humanity and justice. And the only way that we win is if we fight back together across communities and across generations.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm co-host Steve Rohde. I'm joined by Maria Hall today, and we're speaking with Dahlia Taha of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Dahlia, we're also seeing mainstream media and university donors help push a narrative that equates criticism of Israel with hate and anti-Semitism. How is MPAC confronting Trump's legacy of anti-Muslim executive orders? He is elevating the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, which includes political criticism of Israel. We're facing the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in the Senate. Tell us about all of those attacks on free speech and public criticism.
That's a great question, Steve. And I think that it wouldn't be an exaggeration to outline that this is one of the most dangerous developments that we're actively facing right now. The weaponization of anti-Semitism to shut down legitimate political speech and dissent. MPEC has been very clear, anti-Semitism is real and it's dangerous and it must be confronted and addressed. But the criticism of a government, especially one engaged in occupation and violence, is not hate. And we're pushing back on these false definitions in policy spaces, in legal analysis, and in media narratives. And we've also been engaging with a variety and a multitude of different Jewish organizations who have expressed the same exact thing. They will not stand idly and allow this new administration to weaponize anti-Semitism in order to suppress speech. They are these different groups that we have worked with. We've actually formed a coalition of Muslim organizations and Jewish organizations who are working to address what's going on and be able to fight back against it, because you cannot weaponize anti-Semitism in order to promote Islamophobia. From these coalition groups, we've also been working to brief members of Congress and working with civil rights lawyers to challenge universities' policies, because, as you mentioned, the IRA definition of anti-Semitism has made its way into our academic institutions and in university policies. So we have been looking and researching with these Jewish organizations positive alternatives and been working with the actual creator of the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, Kenneth Stern. This was never his intention when he created that definition. And these aren't definitions when it comes down to. One thing that we've outlined is these definitions aren't about protecting Jewish students. They're about silencing dissent, silencing Palestinian voices, and anyone who speaks out in solidarity. We're defending the right to dissent and insisting that free speech cannot be conditional on political convenience. And you will not use anti-Semitism to push hate, because, as I mentioned in the beginning, anti-Semitism is very real. It's a problem. It's something that we all actively have to work to address together to protect Jewish individuals and Jewish communities. But it cannot be weaponized to silence another group of people.
I'm so glad to hear you mention your coalitional work. I'm very active with Bend the Arc, a Jewish Partnership for Justice, which is part of that coalition and is clearly calling it a smokescreen to use anti-Semitism to punish free speech. As a quick follow-up, how are you collaborating with Black, Latino, Asian American, Indigenous groups to build cross-community resistance to surveillance, state repression, and criminalization? What does solidarity look like at this moment?
So solidarity isn't just a slogan. It's a strategy. It is one of our key values. It's one of our core missions. MPAC is in a deep coalition with Black, Latino, Asian American, and Indigenous organizers across the United States, because we know that this fight isn't just about Muslims or Palestinians. It's about all of us who've been targeted by the state, surveilled in our schools, and criminalized in our communities, as we've seen throughout all of these other communities. We're co-hosting briefings and webinars. We just worked with LOLAC, a very prominent Latino organization, in addressing what's happening in the Latino community and the Muslim community, and how we can come together and address what's happening while simultaneously finding strategies to work together. Because what's happening to the Latino community, and specifically the Mexican community, isn't exclusive to them. And we need to be able to best support them and come together as allies. We've also joined other national coalitions and aligned our legislative demands to be able to advocate not just for our Muslims, but for those groups as well. Whether it's ending the 1033 program, fighting gang databases, or opposing campus militarizations, in this moment, solidarity means showing up when it's not just your name on the headline. It means recognizing that our struggles are linked, and so is our liberation. That is one thing that we prioritize and emphasize within our organization. It's not just all about us. It's about other communities as well. And we need to be able to protect other communities as we protect our own. This was also seen within our UCE militarization campaign that is ongoing. We collaborated with one of our coalition partners, the NAACP, because as we know, the violence that is often seen, the criminalization in our communities, predominantly affects the Black and African American community. So we were very grateful to be able to collaborate with the NAACP to call on the UC system to demilitarize their campuses so Muslim, Arab, Black, African American students don't feel as if they're being persecuted and aren't facing criminalization and abuses on their campuses.
Dahlia, along those lines, as we move into the next 4 years, what's at stake for civil liberties, campus justice, and Muslim political power? And how is MPAC preparing for what's next?
Everything is at stake. Our democracy is at stake. Our country is at stake. We're entering this critical window where civil liberties are being eroded in plain sight. They're not trying to hide it anymore. From students being arrested on the streets for protests, to legislation trying to silence dissent, to government agencies being weaponized against marginalized community, our democracy is at stake. A few weeks ago, we saw Ramisa, who was a student on a green card, be snatched off the street without due process. Mahmoud Khalil, it just came out recently that there actually was not a warrant out for his arrest when he was taken in plain sight in front of his pregnant wife and then is still being detained to this day. Campus justice is under assault. And if we do not act now, we risk losing everything. And that includes academic freedom. That includes the right to organize and even the ability to safely express our political beliefs, whatever they are. That is at risk. For the American Muslim community specifically, it's not about just surviving this political movement. It's about building long-term power. At MPAC, we're preparing by developing our next generation of leaders and empowering them to not shy away from speaking the truth, from speaking up. But that consists of also educating and informing them of how what their rights are. That also consists of educating and informing them of what their rights are. It's expanding our policy footprint and building our coalition partners and our work so it's not just catered to the Muslim community. We have to be able to advocate and work with other groups and other communities and stay deeply rooted in these movement spaces. We're not just reacting, we're organizing, legislating, and shaping the narrative on who we are and what we stand for overall. What we're witnessing is this deliberate effort to collapse any criticism of Israel into anti-Semitism, and that is so incredibly dangerous, not just for Palestinians and our allies, but the integrity of free speech within our country, but specifically in our institutions. The Muslim Public Affairs Council has been actively fighting back in the halls of Congress and against legislation such as the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which is also known as AAA, and that sought to codify the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. That definition had been so widely criticized, even by the original drafter, Kevin Stern, for being overly broad and conflating political critique of Israel with bigotry. And if it had passed, AAA would have given the federal government this dangerous authority to investigate and also potentially punish students and educators for advocating for Palestinian rights while educating about Israel. So we worked with a multitude of different stakeholders. We're very proud of this collaborative effort. We partnered with J Street, a very prominent Jewish community, to educate and inform lawmakers and the community about its implications. We are a C3, so we don't do any lobbying, so we didn't go and lobby legislation, but we did actively work with our community to ensure that people were very informed on the implications of AAA and that it was essential to oppose these government policies, especially those involving occupation, apartheid, and human rights violations. And we're very happy to know that this bill has been paused within Senate, and it is presumably not going to move past Senate. And that makes us very, very pleased with our own collaborative work and our work on the ground and work with our coalition partners, that if you sit idly and allow these sorts of legislations to pass and you don't engage with your elected officials, that could have just passed. The AAA could have just passed. And who would have known what that would have meant for our country and our institutions at large. So that's something that we take a lot of pride in, is work of educating the community and engaging with legislative makers and elected officials to combat and address problematic legislation.
Dahlia, our time together is coming to a close. What do you want listeners to know about how they can support MPAC's work or take action on their own and in their own communities to defend civil liberties and push back on authoritarianism? How can they reach MPAC and learn more?
You can find MPAC at our website at MPAC.org. And you can also find the Muslim Public Affairs Council on all forms of social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you will be able to engage with all of us there. You see our efforts. We have a lot of action items and a lot of call to actions. But if I were to give a word of advice, is start where you are. If you're a student, organize. If you're a parent, show up to school board meetings. If you have a platform, use it to speak the truth. And if you're watching all of this unfold and wondering what you can do, support the organizations like MPAC, not just financially, but amplifying our campaigns, joining our advocacy efforts, and helping us protect our communities. Authoritarianism thrives on silence and fear, and our power is in collective action, in refusing to normalize injustice, and in building the infrastructure we need to outlast these attacks. This moment demands that we're all courageous and we all use our voices to speak up and speak out. We all have a responsibility and we all have a role to play, and it is essential that we step into those roles.
Dahlia, Maria, and I are so pleased to have had you today. I personally am looking forward to Rapid Response, our podcast that you and I are co-hosting. Thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for allowing me for the opportunity to be on this radio show. It's been such an honor. It was such a great experience.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
One of the most consequential pillars of U.S. military power is also one of its most overlooked, our vast network of overseas military bases. In his meticulously researched book, Base Nation: How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, author and anthropologist David Vine reveals how more than 800 U.S. military installations scattered across foreign lands are not merely symbols of strength. They often are sources of harm. From the Pacific Islands to the Middle East and Europe, these bases have become fixtures of the American empire. However, they rarely receive the scrutiny they deserve from policymakers or the public. David Vine documents how this sprawling network of bases fuels geopolitical tension, fosters anti-American resentment, and props up authoritarian regimes. He shows how U.S. bases displace local populations, pollute ecosystems, and even affect the mental health and family lives of U.S. troops stationed abroad. And while Pentagon officials downplay the cost, Vine's analysis reveals that maintaining these foreign outposts drains nearly $100 billion, that's billion, each year from U.S. taxpayers, money that could instead fund urgent domestic priorities. Perhaps most troubling is how these bases have enabled decades of interventionist wars, making it easier for the U.S. to engage militarily across the globe without addressing root causes of conflict or engaging in genuine diplomacy. We're pleased to be joined today by David Vine to discuss what a post-base foreign policy might look like, who benefits from the current system, and what's behind the emerging bipartisan calls to rein it in. A writer and political anthropologist, David was a professor of anthropology at American University for 18 years, from 2006 to 2024. He is also the author of Islands of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and thank you for that incredibly kind introduction. And I love the phrase post-base world and post.
This is Shannon Lee Reynolds. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruisin' the Decades.